Hey, it's Melissa from Melissa in the Morning on WICC 600, and thanks for checking out the podcast right here. If you want, you can always subscribe, share, and like it. Hope to see you guys soon. Thanks.
The latest from the state capitol about your own neighborhood. Connecticut Senate Majority Leader Bob Duff stops by Melissa in the Morning. Now on WICC 600.
And speaking of the neighborhood, Senator Duff, I know we're going to be diving into the zoning bill and some other big pieces of legislation that are being voted on in Hartford. But I did want to start with something that's national and kind of bring it to more of a local platform, if you don't mind. A lot of people have been talking about what's been rumbling in Georgia. Of course, the bill that's looking at voting and needing a photo ID to come out and vote. Now, there have been obviously a lot of controversial remarks on this, the biggest one being that it discriminates. It keeps people from wanting to vote. It's actually been called racist, in fact. And I was looking up. It turns out Connecticut does not require you to have an ID to vote. I'm curious as to why. Like, why don't we require it when we require it for not only like alcohol and travel, but even just to get your COVID vaccine, you need a photo ID. So why don't we require it to vote?
Well, good morning, Melissa, and happy Easter to folks who were celebrating yesterday, and it's always great to be on here with you. You know, this is a really fundamental question because, you know, in our Constitution, it talks about voting and how we can keep our democracy strong. And I think that, you know, everybody wants to make sure that there's no voter fraud, that it's one person, one vote, and that there's no cheating, and that we're doing everything possible to ensure the sanctity of the vote in our elections, and that there's no question whatsoever in the fact that, you know, the winner is the winner, and each vote counts the way it should be. Mm-hmm. So here in Connecticut, and again, let me just start by saying that, you know, despite the contrary, and despite kind of conspiracies and rumors and, you know, alike, there's very, very, over the last 20, 30 years, all the different reports and studies, there's practically none, if very little, if any, voter fraud that's out there. So this is not a widespread problem. It's not an issue that we have to kind of curtail. And here in Connecticut, we've done studies as well, and there is little to none. I mean, when I say none, like really none, voter fraud. If somebody goes in and votes, you are asked for some sort of an identification to show who you are. So I've shown for many years my driver's license, and that's an acceptable form of ID. though people can also say a test by signing something that they are who they are. And if you engage in voter fraud, you become a felon in the state of Connecticut and the federal government in about 10 seconds. So the price for voter fraud is extremely high, meaning that if somebody goes in and says, I'm not Bob Duff, I'm somebody else, or somebody says that they're me, they become an instant felon, both on the state level and on the federal level as well. And that's why one of the reasons why I think we haven't had that kind of those kind of problems. But you know as well as I do, when people go into the voting booth, go to vote on Election Day, they're bringing their license, they're bringing some sort of ID. Like you can bring a bill, mm-hmm. You can bring a different type of ID. What's going on in places like Georgia is that they will say that a college ID from one particular college is a type of ID that's acceptable, but an ID from a traditional college, another college is not acceptable. For example, they will say an ID at maybe the University of Georgia is okay, but an ID from a traditional African American college is not okay. So that's where they have the issues of voter fraud, because then it becomes suppression, where not everybody has the opportunity to get the particular type of ID that is required in the state of Georgia or other places, where, you know, if you're older or if you don't have transportation or you don't drive, you may not have that necessity every single day to have an ID, and then therefore, you know, when it comes time to voting, you just don't qualify. So we try in Connecticut to expand everybody's access to voting, not to restrict their access to voting. And what we saw, and there is a study that showed even with the absentee balloting that we did this past election, that there is little or no there's really no advantage for either party to embrace or not embrace these types of proposals. They're really good for everybody, and that what they end up doing is they end up getting more and more people to exercise their right to participate in this, in our democracy, and vote for whoever they want to vote for.
Senator Duff, though, my question, you know, in regards to the becoming a felon if you do sign that piece of paper, how often, though, do we investigate people who we think, ooh, I don't know if you're breaking the law right now? I mean, do we even really investigate people that thoroughly that we would know if they were pretending to be somebody else when they go to vote?
Yeah, absolutely. There's if somebody puts in a complaint, or if a registrar puts in a complaint, or one of the moderators puts in a complaint, those complaints are absolutely investigated, for sure, 100%. But we also have restrictions on, say, absentee balloting. Like that's why we have a two-step process for absentee balloting, where you have an absentee ballot application, then you actually have the absentee ballot. And actually, in some states, absentee ballots are automatically just sent to everybody. And again, there is little to no fraud whatsoever. There has not been widespread fraud. So this it's a terrible conspiracy that really undermines the confidence people have in our democracy by saying that somehow the election has been stolen, or the stop the steal stuff. It is really a terrible precedent to set in our country, and it undermines everything that we stand for, which is the right for people to go and vote on Election Day, mm-hmm. And to have their voice, and to somehow say that it should be more difficult when there is no measurable voter fraud is really just excluding people who we want to have get out there and vote on Election Day. Everybody should have their voice. If you qualify to vote, you should be out there voting on Election Day.
Totally. And I think the only thing, Senator Duff, that I would say is I don't particularly think that the election was rigged. I happen to think that being able to mail in your ballot did make it where more people could get their voices heard. I agree with it. I know that there's a lot of controversy around it. To me, I do think it was helpful in the voter process. Because this really comes down to the president of the United States. Do I think that there was voter fraud? There might have been, but I was pretty sure that President Biden was going to win, if I'm being honest with you. I wasn't really, I just felt like there was so much controversy around President Trump that I was pretty positive President Biden was going to make it in. So I don't even really fully buy the idea of like the fraud around that. But you do have to kind of wonder, it's different. The world we live in now is different. We are dealing with border issues. We are dealing with issues where people are able to vote without really even having something checked, like, and I agree that I'm sure they're investigating it when someone complains, but I have to wonder, do people even really complain and go, oh, the person who was in front of me, I don't think they're a U.S. citizen, or I don't think it's that person? I don't know how often that's really happening.
You know, again, there have been investigations, there's been studies, and this goes back decades and decades, where there have been in Connecticut, there have been multiple states, and all I can say is that every time there's been a study, there has been shown that there is little to no voter fraud whatsoever. And again, in Connecticut, at least, you do have to show something, or you have to sign something that says you are who you are. And again, if somebody then comes back and says, if somebody says they're Bob Duff and that person votes for me, I go in, then whoever came and voted for me is going to be in big trouble. So I'm not sure that it's worth somebody to become a felon because of the fact that they want to be me or somebody else. It's just easier just to register to vote and go vote. And you know, these conversations about somehow people are going in and voting for somebody else, or they're not, you know, they're you know, voting the wrong way, or what, I don't even know, you know, all the different arguments. It's just again, through the studies over decades, just has not happened. It's just not something that is an issue that has been a problem in this country. And there's every state runs their own elections enforcement, and every state runs their own elections. This is not a national, there's no national laws really on
right.
How that is run.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and again, you have some states that do early voting for weeks. You have some states that do the automatic absentee ballots. You have some states that do the drop boxes. All those kinds of things have proven, like in Florida, after the 2000 debacle, They did early voting. They did drop boxes, absentee balloting, all, you know, all these types of things. They have not turned from a red state to a blue state. In fact, they probably turned more red. But it shows, again, that that those measures help bring out more people to vote, and it doesn't help one side or the other.
We were talking about voter IDs. Senator Duff and I don't quite agree, but, you know, it's good to have these conversations. That's what it's all about. Senator Duff, I do want to kind of switch gears really quick. I appreciate your extra time this morning and talk about zoning. What is the latest with the zoning bill here in Connecticut?
Well, the zoning bills, a couple zoning bills have passed the Planning and Development Committee. So we'll wait to see what they all look like once they reach the House and Senate floors. But some of the more controversial features have been taken out. But I still think it's important legislation to move forward on this legislative session from a standpoint of the fact that Connecticut is one of the most segregated states in the nation, and the fact that we need to make sure that we're doing everything we can to help to build housing that works for all income folks around the state of Connecticut, and that we have communities that are open to everyone and welcoming to everybody. And that has not been happening because of restrictive zoning laws over the years. So this is not a I just want to make sure that people know it's not a state takeover of zoning. It's not abolishing what's called home rule in our state constitution. But what this does is to help encourage housing to be built, especially affordable housing, in communities that may not have it, and to help move along some projects that and some building that needs to happen.
I was going to ask, what was taken out? You said a couple controversial parts were taken
out.
Yeah,
the piece about transit-oriented development around a train station, which is actually not bad policy. It's just maybe it was a little too, the area was a little too big. I think it was within a half mile of a train station. Norwalk is already doing it, but maybe some other towns need some more flexibility on that. And I think there was also another provision about putting housing on a main street, and that was taken out as well for, I guess, because of either lack of support in the committee or because it was, to try and make it a little more palatable among both sides of the aisle on the bill. Unfortunately, it only passed on a partisan vote. But I do believe that the leadership of the committee is going to be working to make it a bipartisan bill if possible.
But there's nothing in there like compromise of keeping mayors or first select men or women or zoning departments of towns and cities. They're still not included in these decisions, correct, with the current bill?
They're not excluded from making decisions, if that's what you're asking.
Okay, because my understanding from many mayors and first selectmen who have come on the show is that they would not really have a say in some of these projects. It would really come down to just our state government deciding.
No, I don't think so, and that's not how I see it. Again, the bill, the desegregate bill, Senate Bill 1024, is one that actually has been endorsed by the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, and they have worked very closely with the group to ensure that it works with cities and towns all across the state of Connecticut. So that's not my understanding of the bill at all.
Okay, so they're just getting that wrong? Like, where would they get that idea then?
I haven't heard them say that, so I can't really comment on it, but I can just say that 1024 has had it has testimony even by the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities. So if some of them are doing a 180, or if they view it differently than maybe their organization did, that may be the case, but in looking at the bill the way I've seen it, and I haven't put a deep dive into it, but there's nothing in the bill that says that they have no say whatsoever in zoning anymore. That wouldn't be the case. I don't even think that would be constitutional because of the fact of our home rule provision in the state constitution, and the fact that that wouldn't even pass committee at all.
Okay. Well, Senator Duff, I so appreciate the extra time this morning. Thank you so much, and we'll talk again next week.
Okay, I look forward to it. Thank you.
All right.
What's going on in the Capitol and how it affects you? State Senator Tony Wong joins Melissa in the Morning right now on WICC 600.
Okay, so now I would love to hear from Senator Tony Wong. Some of the questions I asked Senator Duff, would love to hear your answers on it. First of all, talking about a national story that has impacted people here in Connecticut. While it's not a law here, in Georgia, they did pass the election bill requiring you to have photo ID in order to vote. And Senator Wong, I noticed we do not require ID here in Connecticut. And when I talked to Senator Duff about this, he said there's little to no fraud that goes on here in Connecticut. That's why we don't have it. And it also turns voters away. So my question is, then why do we require IDs for things like getting a COVID vaccine? It's a very hard argument to say that we're turning people away from voting if we require an ID, but we're okay with risking that when it comes to the COVID vaccine during a pandemic. So your thoughts on this?
Good morning, Melissa, and hope you had a happy Easter and for those Passover. I love that you have a Democrat and a Republican offering different contrasting viewpoints. In regards to photo identification, you're right. The state of Connecticut does not require. The form identification could be a utility bill or any printed material that has your name and address on it. That being in reality opens the door for a lot of questionable interactions. To the question of voter fraud that exists in Connecticut, you know what? Voter fraud does exist. Mm-hmm. But to the point, does it affect elections? I do not believe so. So for those people that thought that the 2020 election was taken away, I don't think it had that impact on a national election. What really does have an impact on voter fraud is on primaries. With small voter turnout and the margins of vote differences are so small. Case in point, in Bridgeport, during the latest mayoral election last year, there was a real concern in regards to absentee ballot voter fraud. So there was a concern. It actually went up to the courts, and the courts determined that there was some malfeasance in regards to absentee ballots. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it was too late in the process. And in fact, when we had mail-in absentee ballots for this upcoming election cycle, there was actually a Bridgeport Democratic senator who requested a monitor in Bridgeport specifically because of their concern for voter fraud action. So voter fraud does exist. Does it turn elections on the national basis? I don't believe so. Mm-hmm. In regards to a photo ID, that has always been a vexing question. For example, I just got my vaccine shot, COVID vaccine. They required a photo identification to be sure that someone else wasn't taking the shot that wasn't supposed to.
Correct.
We don't think twice about it, but there is that argument in regards to photo identification that there may be individuals who don't drive, people that are economically or don't have any photo identification. How do you discriminate against them? The reality at hand is we give free photo ID at DMV if you're not able to pay for it. And that we have photo IDs and many other forms. And it is part and parcel. We require it for proof of age in alcohol consumption.
Right.
We require it in this COVID examination. There are needs for photo ID to just identify a face to the individual. Now, the uproar that you talk about, Melissa, is what happened in Georgia.
Right, exactly.
And I'm going to pivot to say this is what happens when one-party rule dominates the electoral the policy process. It had a Republican governor, Republican House, and Republican Senate, and they pushed through a bill that had no viewpoints and contrasting arguments to try to get the other point of view. It's a flip-flop of what we talk about so often in Connecticut.
Right.
One-party rule in Connecticut of Democrats. What happened in Georgia was one-party rule
Republican.
Of Republicans who may have been concerned about voter election results of electing two Democratic U.S. senators, and there is that concern in regards to impact on elections. Now, Georgia is particularly poignant, Melissa. I'll tell you why. Because of the history. You know, going back when the 15th Amendment was approved, Southern states, Georgia being one of them, instituted a poll tax that restricted African-American access to vote. And there's a ugly history of restrictions and prohibitions and obstacles to voting.
Mm.
So what happened in Georgia was one party rule dictating a policy that just kind of rehashed potential obstacles of voting that brought up our ugly history of restricting all aspects of voting from all minority groups and disparate groups.
But
so,
I mean, history
to that.
Yeah, I mean, and actually, I appreciate you giving us that information because I wasn't fully aware of that. But I think the bigger focus, the reason that they're doing this, is because of two things. I think that we would be remiss to think about what Georgia represented during the presidential election. Do I think that it would have made the biggest difference? I don't know. Do I think that there were enough claims? They were somewhat baseless in President Trump losing in the election. You know, to me, I could see why this happened in Georgia. And like you said, you know, this was a reversal that we see here in Connecticut. You see one party law. But, you know, I do think there's another reason behind it. And it's the fact that we are having issues with the border. I think that's another big thing. I mean, I was shocked this morning because, like you said, you go through the motions. I'm used to bringing an ID with me everywhere. As far as I know, every time I voted, they ask for an ID. I show it to them. So I was shocked that we don't even have it here in Connecticut. But most places don't make you have an ID to vote. I think that's bizarre when you can't go to a doctor's appointment or to a hospital without showing an ID. I think it's bizarre. So, like, are we going to turn people away from care, from health care? You know what I'm saying? Like, I think I hear exactly what you're saying. I just think there's a disconnect here that this is why people are chiming in on it, is we require it for so many other things in our day-to-day lives, but this is being made political with, like, the voting. It does make sense to me why you would need an ID to vote.
Look, it is not racist to require an ID. Is it an economic challenge? But we can make efforts as a state to provide photo identification. The reality at hand is we use this as a political process. In all elections, and ultimately the power of electorals and the impact on policymaking is very real. So when you look at that, it's sort of saying, you know, in our history, in our country, in regards to restricting vote. But photo IDs, we do it as part and parcel of every part of what we do day in and day out. Why are we not doing it for the very, very precious right of voting, which is one of the greatest rights we have in democracy? Mm-hmm. It turns out there's a disconnect on that.
Mm.
And I always wondered that as well. But people bring up the disenfranchisement. And it really becomes a point of view of, look, if you value the vote and you value the sanctity of one person, one vote, what is wrong with regards to requiring a standard or threshold saying you are you and you're casting a vote?
Right.
Another big question that photo ID does not address is we are now going greater into absentee ballots.
Mm-hmm.
Just as
right.
evident in Bridgeport,
mm-hmm.
there is a potential for malfeasance because unless we change the law in regards to early absentee voting, most people are breaking the law in itself.
Right.
Right.
Right. We're seeing it constantly. Yeah.
You know, you only have four reasons to request absentee ballot, except for this year due to COVID. But the reality is we need to change that law, but we also need to ensure that safer guidelines are that people shouldn't be signing out 500 absentee ballots and handing it out to various entities that and then mail their votes in.
Mm.
Because whether it's right or wrong, whether it's correct or incorrect, once a mail ballot goes in and gets checked in by the town clerks, it's a vote counted.
It's counted. Right.
You can't go
right.
back.
Right. Right. And I want to switch gears from voter IDs to zoning legislation. Now, earlier in the show, Senator Bob Duff had said there were a couple big controversial parts of the zoning legislation taken out. He included transit-oriented development near train stations. That's been taken out. And putting housing on main streets in different towns and cities. Is that enough for you, Senator Huang, to want to pass the zoning legislation?
Well, there were more than just a couple of bills. There were at least four or five that directly impacts zoning, land use, and housing that passed out of the Planning and Development Committee. And unfortunately, there are potentially four or five other bills across different committees in finance, in housing, So there is a plethora of zoning and housing bills that are floating around in the General Assembly that have passed out of committee that could be voted on at any time. I do want to say that our committee process works very, very collaboratively. We may disagree passionately, but we work collaboratively in making some solutions. So I may be knowing things a little more in the detail as a planning and development ranking member than Senator Duff. That being said, they did remove Section 6, which looked at transit-oriented development and Main Street development, which kind of really was a half-mile radius that they can build as of right,
right,
which says that they can put density units in those half-a-mile radius without any public hearing, without any local input. And that was removed, and that was an important concession.
So that's
from
good.
The committee chairs that we worked with. But there are other components that give has of right requirements. When we say has of right, that means the state mandate and policies overrule the local, and you will not have a local public hearing that you have in planning and development, conservation, watershed protection. When they say these bills pass with has of right, that means the state is telling you what we say goes, and you have no recourse of local public input.
Okay.
Another significant factor is the fact that we now have a speaker's bill. The majority leader in the House proposed the bill 6611, which uses, I use the word, a stick to mandate and to push our municipalities to meet the affordable housing moratorium, and it almost serves as a legal consent decree, which translates to English for me is saying, if you don't do it, we're going to continue to punish you, because you are not meeting the goals that we think is better for your local municipalities.
Okay, so to me, kind of dictating, but also a little bit of exclusion. I mean, we have heard from our own town leaders. We've heard from First Selectmen and Women. We've heard from mayors who are on the fence about this one. They really don't feel comfortable with the way zoning legislation is. And the big reason, Senator Huang, which we've talked about, is this idea of removing them from the process. Now, I point blank twice just asked Senator Duff, does this bill exclude town leaders? He said, I know nothing in this bill that says anything about that. He says nowhere in there does it talk about excluding anybody.
I have to disagree, because the has of right and the consent decree removes the local input on policies where the state believes that their approach to solving the problem, and we do have a problem for accessible, affordable, and diverse housing
in
all of our communities, not just the suburbs, but in our cities, in our rural area, and the solution that's being offered by the one-party rule is the fact that we, the state, are telling you that local municipalities that don't meet the moratorium on affordable housing and 830G as a statute is not working well enough, that we're going to create a consent decree, or we're going to put carrots, or in some cases, sticks to make you oblige. That's the difference, is the fact that we're striving to get the solutions, but unfortunately, the state believes that it knows better than the local municipality. Mm-hmm. I will disagree, and I'm really grateful that Senator Duff, as the majority Senate leader, says that home rule is a constitutional right, because ultimately there are colleagues in planning development and throughout the General Assembly that believes that zoning is a state purview that they enable to allow local municipalities to manage. That is a philosophical difference. I believe that home rule and local zoning authorities and taxation is critical to local governance. Let the people in the local community that know best. But I'm really grateful that Senator Duff did say that home rule is a constitutional right in this state. That's a powerful statement. I'm grateful for him to have said that, because ultimately, you know, any one of these bills, Melissa, all you have to do at the end of every bill is to say subject to local municipal approval.
Right.
That's all you need to say.
Yeah.
Because our municipalities are striving, whatever challenges that may be different in different locations in our state, as long as you allow local municipal input, it's important.
So yeah, exactly.
Those amendments, Melissa, but I'm going to share with you the problem with this. The proponents of Desegregate Connecticut has said, has these bills passed out of committee? They want to remove that amendment. And it's no different than the public option bill that passed out of the insurance committee that had the amendment to make it a little bit more accountable and transparent. The proponents of the public option are now saying they want to remove the amendment that greater transparency and accountability is happening. So when things talk about in the processes, I appreciate the opportunity to update the public because it's never over till the bell rings for the end of session because anything can happen. And particularly when you look at one party control.
It becomes a real problem.
Not be able to be heard.
Senator Huang, I'm so sorry we've run out of time, but I thank you so much for the extra time this morning, and I look forward to talking to you more next week.
My best to everybody, and have a happy and safe week.
Thank you. You too.
Fighting against injustice across Connecticut, Melissa in the Morning checks in with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities on WICC 600.
And this morning, I'm excited to have George Welch on the line with us, has a background in criminal law and attorney this morning. George, thank you so much for coming on. How are you?
I'm doing very well, Melissa. Thanks for having me today.
Yeah, of course. So first of all, before we even get into police accountability here in Connecticut, obviously, let's talk a little bit about what's going on in the aftermath of the George Floyd case in the trial that is ongoing with the officer who kneeled on his neck. What are sort of your thoughts on how this is all playing out now?
Well, the Derek Chauvin trial is certainly a huge piece of thinking about police accountability. Obviously, not just in Connecticut, but around the country. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, stands out to me about it, you know, beyond the obvious tragedy of George Floyd being killed, is the fact that there's people within the system who are beginning to stand up to police officers taking bad acts. And you're seeing that in a somewhat unprecedented way in this trial. There was firing EMS officials who've testified against Derek Chauvin, and you don't normally see that. And later today, Derek Chauvin's chief is going to be coming in and testifying for the prosecution against him. And that's nearly unprecedented. I mean, I've never heard of it happening. If it's happened before, it's extremely rare. And obviously we'll see what his testimony is, but the prosecution was quite clear in their opening that this chief is coming in to condemn Derek Chauvin and say that what he did was excessive and outside of his training. And seeing that is a significant movement. It certainly opens the door to wondering if we'll be seeing more chiefs taking that sort of responsible kind of action in relation to their officers.
I mean, it definitely represents the idea of when people worry about sort of like, hey, I got your back, you got my back, we're going to go down, you know, together sort of thing. It definitely breaks that barrier. I agree with you. But George, I am curious sort of your thought. You know, part of it is, look, in the case of Derek Chauvin, you know, here's a guy who did have a record of having a lot of complaints against him before everything happened with George Floyd. And my question is, why did this guy stay on the force? I think that's what kind of continues to come up. And part of me feels like, and maybe this is devil's advocate, but I'm honestly asking as a journalist, you know, part of me feels like, is the chief doing this because he's got to save his own rear end? Because I think that question continues to come up. Why are these officers? There's not, you know, it's not the majority, but there are officers who stay on the force when they've done something wrong, horribly wrong, and they continue to serve until you got caught. Now everyone's going to turn on him. You know what I'm saying here? Like, it also kind of shows where we still have an issue of removing people, but, you know, when they've already made a mistake, or if we see the red flags, we kind of turn a blind eye to it until something horrible happens sometimes.
Sure. I mean, and what, you know, and what a troubling thing it is. Like, the thin blue line is certainly a very real thing. And, you know, I think we look today and we see if this is a crack or if it is just a grandstanding. I think that there's a lesson to be learned here. Because I think when we think about police accountability, and I hear it from a lot of people, they'll say, you know, there's nothing we can do about it. This is an inevitable outcome of having police, and we need police. And I think that the first key step to understanding this is a choice that we're making. We don't have to allow police to be able to exist in a state where they're able to get away with nearly impunity to whatever they do. If we continue to pressure through showing up at protests, through supporting Black Lives Matter, for getting in touch with our local and state and federal representatives who are considering drawing back police immunity standards and who are considering defund police options, that sort of pressure is the kind of things that can make police more accountable. It's a choice we're making, and I think if we keep putting on the pressure, it will basically force things like what's hopefully going to happen today, where this chief steps up and holds one of his officers accountable.
Talking to George Welch this morning, who's with the Commission on Human Rights and Opportunities with a background in criminal law. And, you know, let's talk about police accountability. The law that we passed in a matter of weeks after everything sort of erupted with the George Floyd case, it's been very controversial, as you know. There are parts of it that even police say, yeah, absolutely, we should have that across the board. That should be happening. But most of our municipal police are already following it, and our state police. But then there are some things in there that they feel like they are being subjected to that most other people shouldn't, like the immunity idea. You know, it was presented to us that if you work in other sectors that have the immunity in place, it's not like it's getting removed for them, but it is being removed for police. Do you believe, George Welch, that we passed this way too quickly for something so, to me, delicate? This is a very delicate thing because, you know, we also have seen people attack police. Police who have proven that they've been good men and women, have been protecting our areas. They were attacked for no reason when they've been serving for 10, 20, 30 years on the force. And now we're seeing people leaving because they feel like people don't trust our local police. Do you feel like we passed the accountability too quickly here in Connecticut? Did we put this now on our local police, kind of naming them as, hey, we want to make sure you're good, even though they've kind of already proven that. Most of them have proven that.
Sure. I can certainly understand that critique in that position. But honestly, no, I don't. I think we probably passed this way too late. I think we've had to look at a lot of things that have happened over the past 10, 15 years, you know, not just in Connecticut, but around our country. I mean, the list is so troubling at this point. I mean, we have Anthony Veracruz, you know, here in Wethersfield, and Tamir Rice and Eric Gardner and Michael Brown and Laquan McDonald and Walter Scott and Freddie Gray. And then, of course, recently with Breonna Taylor and, you know, going on today, George Floyd. We see these things continuing to happen and happen. And again, getting back to my initial point, we act like this is inevitable. And I think that the Connecticut bill is a baby step in the right direction. You know, honestly, we've heard recently, just that last week, New York passing a qualified immunity elimination bill, and, you know, out of New York City. And that's one that's dramatically going to change police accountability in New York. And the Connecticut bill simply isn't that strong. It's going to bring Connecticut standards in line with federal law. But for the most part, police have already been held to that standard in Connecticut if a federal claim was to be brought against them, and jurisdictionally it could. So I honestly don't think the police accountability law in Connecticut is going to change the standard that dramatically. And I certainly have some concerns about how it's been progressively chipped away even since it's been passed. You know, we've seen the standard getting reduced from what was originally a standard where the police were going to have to exhaust all possible alternatives before using violence against a civilian, to the point now where it was, you know, drawn back to a reasonable belief, and now it's been drawn back to, you know, more legalese, where we talk about objectively reasonable under the circumstances at the time. And the truth is, who knows what that means? I mean, you know, I've been doing criminal law for 15 years, and I can't tell you exactly what that means until a court comments on it. So we're already chipping away at a standard we created before it's even gone into effect. And that concerns me. And we pushed back its effective date already back to January of 2022. And honestly, training police to do the right thing should not be a complex
task.
It shouldn't be something that needs additional months and months of training. And then that's the rationale that the chiefs have been giving for wanting it pushed back. This is something that should be
in place already.
In place already, and the highest priority. If the police are looking to build a strong and you know, foundationally sound relationship with the communities of Connecticut, this needs to be happening today. This needs to have happened years ago, and the police are at a crisis point, I believe. And if they honestly want to find a way to remain an important part of our society, which I think they should be, this needs to happen sooner than later.
George Welch, thank you so much for just talking about this in length. We really appreciate your expertise on the matter, and hopefully we could talk again soon.
Absolutely. I would love to, Melissa.
All right. Thank you so much.